Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1, a transitional year resident that's ultimately going into radiology. And this is episode 104 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this, hopefully what is a quick podcast, I'm going to be describing our ECLS algorithms. I'm basically going to essentially explain how to run a code. And I mean, pretty much, right? A lot of this is also exam testable. This is something you'll likely see on most of the USMLE exams and whatnot. But this is also something that will probably help you in a clinical practice. Okay, so let's begin, right? So let's assume you literally hear it overhead, right? Code blue, right? Code blue is like, crap, someone has coded, right? So your next step is to then run to the code, I guess. So when you run to the code, right, you get to the door, right? The first thing you have to ask is who is running the code, right? Whoever is running the code should not be doing anything. If there is no one running the code and you are able to run the code, then you go ahead and take over and say, identify yourself and say you are running the code. And usually by the time you get there, right, a person would already be there doing chest compressions. And I will sort of, I'll talk about like, oh, let's say a patient codes like right in front of you, what do you do? I'll talk about that in a quick second, but I just want to go ahead and just talk about like some good general things to do if you're the person running a code. And then we'll talk about how to run the code itself, right? So let's assume you're the guy running the code. The first thing you do when you get into a room is you need to identify yourself. You need to say, oh, my name is Divine. I am the one that's going to be running this code, right? After you identify yourself, the next thing you really want to do is to assign tasks to people, right? Assign tasks to people. So you need to have someone that is going to be doing your chest compressions, right? You need someone to be doing that. You need someone that is going to be your electricity guy. Right, so the person that's going to be handling defibrillation or like cardioversions, and then you need to have someone that records, right? So who is going to be recording, like, oh, like this is what happened here, this is what happened here, because believe it or not, at the end of the day, nursing is gonna need that documentation. And then you're gonna need a timer, right? Because timing is extremely important when you're running a code, right? You basically need someone to say, oh, you know, okay, we're getting on the 2 minute mark, it's time to give the next drug. We're running on the 2 minute mark, it's time to defibrillate again, right? So you need someone under those circumstances. And then you also need pharmacy, right? Who do you think is going to give you those drugs that you use in a code? It's going to come from somewhere. It's not going to come from thin air, right? So you need pharmacy under those circumstances. So you need a recorder. You need a compressions person. You need pharmacy. And another person you need is someone that's going to be pushing your drugs, right? So basically like the pill pusher. Person that's going to like push the drugs into that patient. You need those people, okay? And the thing is, again, you don't need millions of people in a room to run a code successfully. I will encourage you to have as few people in the room as possible when you're running a code. And the thing is, as the leader of the code, you want to be calm, you want to be gentle, right? Because the tone of the leader sort of sets the tone for the entire team. So if you're freaked out and you're like, ooh, and you're raising your voice at everyone, right, then that's not very productive for a code, okay? So just calm down, be gentle, take a deep breath. You have that 2 seconds to take a deep breath and think, okay? Go in and just follow the protocol you know. And again, if you're forgetting the protocol, it's not bad to whip out your book and look at the protocol as you're running the code, okay? No one is going to fault you for that. Okay, so if a person codes right in front of you, right, the first thing you're supposed to do is to tap them, right? You tap the patient and say, are you okay? Try to see like if they can respond. If they cannot respond, your next step, right? So again, like literally this podcast, just sort of follow these steps, right? Next thing you do is you try to feel for a pulse, right? So you feel on the carotids for a pulse. If you don't feel a pulse, you say, I don't feel a pulse, blah, 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 I'm starting CPR. And you call for help immediately, right? So, I don't know, you pull the code blue button in the patient's room or whatever, but you call for help and you start CPR, right? So you start CPR, bam, 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 right? So let's assume you start CPR, right? And help then comes in, right? Obviously, they will try to hook up the patient to like the monitor, right? So like hook up the patient to the Zoll and try to identify whatever rhythm they're in, right? So let's assume that the patient's, and again, while all this is happening, someone is doing CPR, right? And remember, CPR, you're doing it at a rate of like 30 to 2, right? So I'm not describing any of the pediatric stuff here. But CPR in adults, you do it at a rate of 30 to 2, right? So you do 30 compressions, right? And in between those 30 compressions, you provide a 2 breaths, okay? So 30 compressions and then 2 breaths. 30 compressions, 2 breaths. So 30 compressions, 2 breaths. Very important to remember that. And remember that your compressions, right? You try to do it at a rate of about 120 per minute, right? And remember the Staying Alive song, right? So it's like the... You can find the song online. It works perfectly. Just follow those rules, right? Then usually you want to compress to a depth of like 2.4, 2.5 or thereabouts. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. And again, about 120 per minute. Now, so let's assume they analyze the rhythm, right? And the person is in VFib, right? So VFib is what's identified on the monitor, right? So the patient's in VFib or like pulseless VTAC. Well, for that, those are shockable rhythms, right? So once you analyze the strip and you see the person is in VFib or pulseless VTAC, continue your CPR. But the next thing you should be thinking about is delivering electricity to the patient. And by electricity, you're going to defibrillate the person, right? Another name for defibrillation is unsynchronized cardioversion. Synchronized cardioversion, I'll talk about that shortly, but that's a different kind of electricity that you're delivering to the patient, right? So VFib, pulseless VTAC, you're going to do an unsynchronized cardioversion, also called the defibrillation. And the thing is, when you do that, right, if you're using like a biphasic defibrillator, you basically can give at 200 joules. If you're using a monophasic, you can give like 360. But for the most part, I'll say 200 joules, like most of the Zolls you see in most hospitals these days. 200 joules for VFib, pulseless VTAC. So you shock the person, right? And how often are you supposed to shock the person? You're supposed to shock them every 2 minutes, right? You're supposed to shock them every 2 minutes. And then, so we've dealt with the electricity part. That's the thing you want to do as quickly and as efficiently as possible, right? Because that's really the thing that can restore the person's rhythm, right? And then in terms of pharmacology, right, the first drug you try to give is epi, right? And the epinephrine dose is 1 milligram. And then after 2 minutes, basically just remember that you can give drugs every 2 minutes. So you give epinephrine 1 milligram first. 2 minutes afterwards, you give amiodarone, okay? Amiodarone, the initial dose is 300 milligrams, right? As an IV push, right? And then after those 2 minutes, you give epi again, 1 milligram. The dose is 1 milligram. And then after that, you give amiodarone again. But the subsequent amiodarone doses are 150 milligrams, right? So, and I'll summarize all this at the end just to make sure you remember all of this. You give amiodarone 150, next you give epi 1 milligram, after that amiodarone 150. And the thing is, you're actually allowed to give a lidocaine, right? After you've given a few doses of like amio, you're actually allowed to give a lidocaine. I believe the dose is like 1 milligram per kilogram. So, I don't know, like the average person, let's say like 100 milligrams pretty much, and you should be solid there. I know before they used to say you can substitute your first dose of epinephrine with vasopressin. That's no longer a thing for VFib or pulseless VTAC. Okay, so quick summary. You do a defibrillation every 2 minutes. Defibrillation is the first thing you want to try to accomplish as quickly as possible. Although remember that in the meantime, when you see the patient, you're doing your chest compressions, 30 to 2, right? About 120 per minute. Keep ringing, Staying Alive in your head. So defibrillation every 2 minutes, and before you defibrillate, right, you want to do like a pulse check and a rhythm check, right? Because what if the patient has moved from a shockable rhythm to one that's no longer shockable, right? So every 2 minutes, basically, you there are three things you want to do. You want to do a pulse check, a rhythm check. You want to shock if it's indicated, and you want to give one drug. If you remember that, like, oh, every 2 minutes I got to do three things, it makes it a lot easier to, it makes a code a lot easier to run. So every 2 minutes for VFib, pulseless VTech, you got to do a pulse rhythm check. You shock if it's indicated, and you give a drug. And the drug is alternating every 2 minutes between epi and amio. Epi and amio. The epi dose is always 1 milligram. The amio dose, the first one is 300 milligrams, and then afterwards it's 150. And down the line, you can give lidocaine at 1 milligram per kilogram, so about 100 milligrams, okay? So that is really how you run a code. Now, what if, same deal, right? You call, you, let's assume you feel a, you don't feel a pulse on the patient. So basically, right, all the steps I talked about where you call, they're not responding. And let's say like you feel a pulse, right? You don't feel a pulse. So you say, I'm starting CPR, right? And let's say that on the monitor, you see like some squiggles, right? So it's not asystole. You're seeing like some squiggles that looks like normal sinus rhythm, but the patient doesn't have a pulse, right? That patient obviously has pulseless electrical activity, right? So pulseless electrical activity, the heart is beating, actually, but those patients don't have enough squeeze to generate a good cardiac output, right? So for that, actually managing a PEA algorithm is a lot easier. There's not many decisions you have to make, because can you shock PEA? You cannot, right? And actually, I'll go ahead and say this right now. The management of PEA and asystole is basically the same, right? So PEA systole, you just start your high-quality CPR, right? High-quality CPR. And then you give epi at your earliest opportunity, right? And the dose of epi, again, is 1 milligram, okay? You give epi, and then you just continue doing your CPR at a rate of 30 to 2, as I described already, 30 compressions, 2 breaths. And the thing is, remember, like I said, for VFib, pulseless VTech, where you can alternate between epi and amio, epi is your only option in a PEA systole, right? In fact, one of my friends gave me this trick. He said all roads lead to epi. In a code, you usually have to give a person epi in some way, shape, or form. And it's 1 milligram, right? So you give epi and you basically wait like every, the official guidelines say every 3 to 5 minutes, right? But I like remembering that like every 2 minutes sort of deal. So just tell yourself, you know what, every 2 minute intervals, so 4 minutes total, you go ahead and give epi. You don't give amio in PEA systole, and you don't shock PEA asystole. And again, remember, every 2 minutes, you make that, you make those three sets of decisions. You do a pulse check and a rhythm check, right? You shock if it's indicated. So if, let's assume they've switched from PEA to like VFib, right? You shock them under those circumstances. And then you also give one drug, right? But remember that you basically, like, if a person is in PEA systole, you're not giving a drug every 2 minutes, you're giving a drug like every 4 minutes. So every two minute intervals, okay? And remember, right, you're supposed to run through your differential of the 5 H's and the 5 T's, right? So the 5 T's, like the tension pneumothorax, the thrombosis, or like a PE, the like toxins, trauma. There's another T. Let's see. So thrombosis, trauma, toxins, tension pneumothorax, tamponade. That's the 5th T, right? And then in terms of your H's, right? So like hypo or hyperkalemia, hypothermia, hypoglycemia, hydrogen ions. So that's like an acidosis. And then like a hypovolemia, okay? So those are the things you sort of want to work through and rule out. Okay, so that's really ACLS in a nutshell, right? But let me just talk about some other arrhythmias real quick. I'll talk about these in like bigger, like more dedicated podcasts, but let's just do a quick drive by through the like a lot of the other arrhythmias, right? And to say like high yield exam testable / clinical things that you'd need to know about them, right? So let's assume a patient has like a white complex tachyarrhythmia, right? So like a regular white complex tachyarrhythmia. The very first thing you should assume is that the patient is in VTech, okay? Now, if the patient is in VTech, there are three decisions you need to make, basically. The first decision you ask yourself is, Does the patient have a pulse or no pulse? If the patient has no pulse, that's ACLS, right? You need to go down that epi-amyo shock every 2 minutes pathway, right? That's it. Your job is done. Now, if the patient has VTAC and they have a pulse, the next thing you have to ask yourself is, are they stable or unstable, right? And by unstable, I mean, are they hypotensive? Are they altered? Are they symptomatic, right? If a patient is symptomatic and they're in VTAC, right, your next step for those people is electricity as well. But the electricity is different this time. It's not a defibrillation. It is not an unsynchronized cardioversion. This time, these people have a synchronized cardioversion. Okay, synchronized cardioversion. Synchronized cardioversion is what you do if a patient has VTAC and they have a pulse, but they are unstable. Okay, synchronized cardioversion. And let's see, what else do I want to mention there? Yeah, that's pretty much it. You do a synchronized cardioversion. Occasionally on MBMEs, you may see that referred to as a direct current cardioversion. It's the same thing. And on MBMEs, you may also see that referred to as direct current counter shock. So just something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, now. So you do a synchronized cardioversion, right? And literally a synchronized cardioversion, the difference between a synchronized and an unsynchronized cardioversion is you're trying to not shock the heart when the person's heart is going through repolarization, right? So that's like the R on T phenomenon you hear about. Because the thing is, if you drop a QRS complex, right? So if you shock the heart when the heart is repolarizing, that can basically go from one rhythm to like VFib, or like really bad VTAC, and then patient can die, right? So you don't want that. So that's why you do a synchronized cardioversion, right? So like that's the whole point behind the sync button on the Zoll. Okay, so the third decision for VTAC, right? Let's assume they have VTAC, they have a pulse, they have really no symptoms, they're like super stable. Then your next step in management is amiodarone. That's it. Okay, amiodarone. Okay, now what if you have a patient, right? And this patient has a narrow complex regular tachyarrhythmia on the monitor, right? So like narrow complex regular tachyarrhythmia, right? So the first thing you want to assume is that they have an SVT, right? They have a supraventricular tachycardia. If a patient has an SVT, right, you can try the vagal crap, right? You can dunk their head in cold water, tell them blow into a straw, massage their carotids. But let's assume that's not working, right? So after that, you proceed to, you want to go ahead and proceed to drugs, right? So the first drug you can give adenosine, right? And the dose is like 6 milligrams, right? The first one you give is 6 milligrams. After the 6 milligrams, if that's not cutting it, you can give 12 milligrams. If that's not cutting, you can give another 12 milligrams, okay? So you give adenosine and you can try to like basically slow their heart down and see if you can sort of get them back to a normal rhythm, or slow the heart down enough to be able to see the arrhythmia they're going through, right? But basically for SVT, right, you basically pursue like you try to control their rate, right? So you can put them on like an IV beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker, right? So you can put them on like a beta blocker like metoprolol or like labetalol even. Or you can use a beta blocker, okay? So a calcium channel blocker. So those are the things you want to keep in mind there. But I mean, if the patient is unstable, the thing I just tell myself is, one easy rule to remember is if a patient is unstable for any reason and they have a rhythm that is not PEA or asystole, you need to give them some kind of electricity. And that electricity is a synchronized cardioversion. The only exception to that rule is VFib, pulseless VTAC. That's why that's called ACLS in the first place. The only exception is VFib, pulseless VTAC, where you do an unsynchronized cardioversion, which is also, again, like I said, called a defibrillation. So, so those are the decisions you make for an SVT. Okay, so if they're unstable at any time, synchronized cardioversion, okay? But for medications, you can give something that basically slows conduction down the AV node, like a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker. And the calcium channel blocker I'm referring to is a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, like verapamil or diltiazem, right? I'm not
talking about like your nifedipine, amlodipine, clavidipine, and whatnot. Those are mainly for those are your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Those are used mainly for blood pressure control. Okay, now what if a person has a, you know, they're sick. You look at the monitor and you're seeing AFib. Right, AFib is like your classic irregular, whatever. Basically, the quick and dirty way to identify AFib, you're looking at the QRS complexes and the spaces between them are not equal, and you're not seeing P waves. If that's what you're looking at, then that's AFib, right? And AFib, right? Again, if they are stable, you can start them on like a beta blocker, so you can pursue like a rhythm or a rhythm control strategy. You can start them on a beta blocker or a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. Another option you can explore is you can use amiodarone, right? So that's a rhythm control strategy. Remember, amiodarone is a class 3 antiarrhythmic, right? So you can use amiodarone for those people. But if a patient has AFib and they're unstable, believe it or not, your next step in management for those people is a synchronized cardioversion, okay? So definitely keep that at the back of your mind. Aflutter, basically the same deal as well. Aflutter, sawtooth pattern on an EKG, okay? Again, if they're unstable, cardioversion, synchronized cardioversion. If they're stable, same treatment, beta blocker or non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil, diltiazem, right? And remember, if a patient has a Wolff-Parkinson-White, you don't want to give them an AV nodal blocking agent. So in those patients, drugs like beta blockers, your non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, digoxin, those are all contraindicated in those people, because if you basically block the AV node in those people, you're like saying, oh, you know what, arrhythmia, I will encourage you to go through this bundle of Kentmore, right? Which is obviously a bad idea, because those patients can degenerate into VFib and die. You don't want that, right? So under those circumstances, the drug of choice for WPW, right, is procainamide, right? Procainamide, don't forget that, procainamide. Okay, in fact, if a patient has AFib with a WPW, you want to go ahead and give a procainamide under those circumstances. Okay, now, and remember, for WPW, you have the classic delta wave, very short PR interval, right? That tells you what you need to do. Now, what if you have a patient and they have like a multifocal atrial tachycardia, right? So MFAT. On exams, that was right. So you see like three or more different P wave morphologies. Remember, MFAT, you really do not shock for the most part. Those people, you just treat their underlying disorder. You can also give them like a beta blocker or a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker and tell them to stop smoking. If they stop smoking, chances are that MAT will resolve. And then what if a patient has like a bradyarrhythmia, right? So let's say they're breathing like their heart rate is like in the 30s, right? For those patients, right, you can consider pharmacology, right? So like atropine, remember atropine is a muscarinic receptor antagonist. So speed up conduction through the AV node. Alternatively, you can consider pacing those people, right? So you can sort of like pace them. You just pace. You can set it at a reasonable rate, I don't know, like 70 bits per minute, whatever. But you can pace those people. So just something to keep at the back of your mind. And remember, I've been saying, oh, if a patient is unstable and it's not VFib, it's not pulseless VTAC, or it's not a PA system where you obviously don't give electricity, I say, oh, do synchronized cardioversion. The synchronized cardioversion dose is like 100 joules, okay? 100 joules, not 200. 200 is generally what's used for VFib pulseless VTAC. So just something to sort of kind of keep at the back of your mind. Okay, and then just sort of running through some high-yield cardiac drugs real quick, right? So remember your antiarrhythmics, right? Amiodarone is like the big one used in ECLS. Remember, it's a class 3 antiarrhythmic. It's a potassium channel blocker, right? Remember, amiodarone can tank a person's pressures, so just sort of keep an eye on your patient's blood pressures. And remember that amiodarone can cause many problems, right? It can cause both a hypo or hyperthyroidism, right? So if you remember that fancy-schmancy Wolff-Chaikoff effect or like Yod-Basedow phenomena, it can cause a hyperthyroidism through those mechanisms. Amiodarone can cause like a blue discoloration of the skin, right? That's another high-yield thing you want to know. And amiodarone can also cause a pulmonary fibrosis, right? So it can cause restrictive lung disease. So like reduced lung volumes, normal FEV1 FVC ratio, normal or increased FEV1 FVC ratio. And because it causes a pulmonary fibrosis, the DLCO will be decreased, right? And then don't forget your class 1 agents, right? So you have your class 1A, 1B, and 1C, your class 1A drugs, right? So you have you have your disopyramide, you have your quinidine, and you have your procainamide. Those are your class 1A agents. And then your class 1B, you have like your lidocaine, your mexiletine, and your tokinide, right? And then your class 1C agents, you have your flecainide and propafenone, okay? Remember that your procainamide, right, is the one that you use in WPW. And remember that procainamide is also associated with drug-induced lupus, right, with those fancy anti-histone antibodies, right, something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Remember that phenytoin kind of works almost like a class 1 antiarrhythmic, right? So that's why phenytoin can have pro-arrhythmic side effects. So that's something you also want to keep at the back of your mind. And remember your class 1 agents are your sodium channel blockers, and they can prolong the QRS, right? They increase your risk of torsade de pointe and stuff like that. And then don't forget your class 2 agents, right? Those are your beta blockers, right? So like metoprolol, labetalol, and whatnot. And then your class 4 agents are your non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like verapamil, diltiazem. Remember that those drugs, right, they also slow down conduction through the AV node. They basically affect like phase 4 of the pacemaker potential, right? And then don't forget your digoxin. Remember digoxin, it does not improve survival like beta blockers do in heart failure, but you can use digoxin certainly for AFib, because digoxin, in addition to being a positive inotrope, right, so it will increase your stroke volume, it will increase your cardiac output. Digoxin also has muscarinic receptor agonist activity, right? So it slows conduction through your AV node, right? And remember the way the digoxin works, right? The digoxin, it inhibits the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So when you do that, you decrease the intracellular concentration of sodium, right? Because remember that, sorry, you will increase, I take that back, whoops. Because remember the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? It pumps 3 sodiums out of the cell and brings 2 potassiums in, right? So if you block the sodium potassium ATPase pump, sodiums will no longer be extruded out of the cell. If the sodiums are no longer extruded out of the cell, they will sort of build up, right? And if they build up, right, that sodium calcium exchanger that you learned while studying for step 1, it won't work anymore, right? It won't work as well. Remember, the job of the sodium calcium exchanger is to bring sodium into the cell and then extrude potassium out of the cell, right? So bring sodium in, extrude calcium. So if your sodium calcium exchanger is not working, because remember, that sodium calcium exchanger is kind of like a secondary active transport mechanism, right? It brings sodium down its gradient into the cell, and then you use that gradient energy of sodium to pump calciums out of the cell. So if you've blocked the sodium potassium ATPase pump with your friendly digoxin, the amount of sodium inside the cell builds up. So that gradient no longer exists between like sodium that is usually very high on the outside and very low on the inside. That gradient doesn't exist. The sodium calcium exchanger basically stops working. So you do not extrude calcium from the cardiac myocyte. So calcium builds up intracellularly, right? And that causes better contractility. And remember that if you're hypokalemic, you have a higher risk of ditch toxicity, right? Because remember that on that sodium potassium ATPase pump, basically, digoxin binds to like the potassium site on that pump. So if you're hypokalemic, it's like there are more open sites for digoxin to bind. So hypokalemia predisposes you to digoxin toxicity. Okay. But the thing is, your friends at the MBME or whatever board exam you're taking, they know people, they try to mess with your head with another potassium issue relating to digoxin, right? So if you're hypokalemic, that increases your risk of ditch toxicity. But if DIG itself causes hyperkalemia as a side effect, right? So why is that, right? Again, again, pharmacology is something you never really should be memorizing. It's something that makes perfect sense if you just sort of think through it, right? So I just told you that the sodium potassium ATPase pump brings 3 sodiums out of the cell and 2 potassiums into the cell. Well, guess what? If you block the sodium potassium ATPase pump, aka which is what digoxin does, you will not be able to bring potassiums into the cell. If you don't bring potassiums into the cell, it will persist outside the cell and get a hyperkalemia. Okay, so the digoxin, by virtue of its mechanism of action, can cause hyperkalemia as a side effect, but being hypokalemic predisposes you to the digoxin toxicity. So the classic exam question will be a person that's like on a diuretic like furosemide and DIG, right? Heart failure, right? And then that furosemide causes hypokalemia and then they get DIG toxicity. And remember that DIG toxicity, right? You treat that with anti-DIG Fab fragments, right? So anti-DIG Fab fragments, I believe it's called a DigiBind, okay? And then some other high-yield drug stuff you want to know. Remember your... Basically, my goal with this podcast was just to go through ACLS, arrhythmias, and then just talk about like random high-yield cardiac drugs, right? So another drug, you can remember your beta blockers, right? They've been shown to improve survival in heart failure. Remember beta blockers, you don't want to give those to a person that comes in like a cocaine overdose, right? Because of that unopposed alpha crap, right? Where they can get like super hypertensive. So if a person comes in with a cocaine overdose, you want to consider giving them like a benzo, or you can give them like an alpha blocker like a phentolamine, or you can give them an alpha beta blocker like labetalol or carvedilol, right? And again, remember, beta blockers, they improve survival in heart failure, but remember, it's only 3 beta blockers that have been shown to do that, right? So like metoprolol, carvedilol, and bisoprolol, those are the ones that have been shown to improve survival in heart failure. Okay, now what are the other drugs that have been shown to improve survival in heart failure, right? Spironolactone is one. Remember, spironolactone is an aldosterone receptor antagonist, right? So remember the classic gynecomastia side effects, because in addition to blocking aldosterone receptors, it also blocks androgen receptors, right? So you can get gynecomastia as a side effect with spironolactone. Remember, spironolactone, you can also use it as prophylaxis, right? In patients that have like really bad liver disease and varices. Okay, and you can also use spironolactone to treat PCOS, right? Because it inhibits 5-alpha reductase in the skin, right? So you can use that under those circumstances. Okay, what other drug has been shown to improve survival in heart failure, right? In heart failure, another drug is Bidyl, right? So the combination of isosorbide and the hydralazine, right? But it's in African Americans that has been shown to improve survival. And then, in terms of other drugs that improve survival, remember your ACE inhibitors, right? So like your lisinopril, captopril, and whatnot. Basically, those drugs, right? ACE inhibitors, right? They inhibit angiotensin converting enzyme. Remember that if a person has bilateral renal artery stenosis, you don't want to give those drugs, right? And then, your ACE inhibitors are almost always the correct answer on NBMEs or any board exam. If they give you a question about like a diabetic, and they say, oh, like reduce their risk of like renal failure in the future and all that crap, give an ACE inhibitor, right? Because remember, by giving an ACE inhibitor, you decrease the formation of angiotensin II. If you think back to your preclinical coursework in med school, remember that angiotensin II, right? It very selectively, when it acts on its type 1 receptors, right? It preferentially constricts the efferent arterial, right? But remember that if you're constricting your efferent arterial, that can cause, because again, think about your kidneys, right? Afferent arterial, glomerulus, efferent arterial. If you constrict your efferent arterial, the pressure, the hydrostatic pressures in your glomerulus will increase, right? So you have like intraglomerular hypertension. And over time, that can cause a hyperfiltration injury, right? Hyperfiltration injury. That can basically screw up your kidneys. So you clearly don't want that, right? So that's why you give ACE inhibitors in diabetes, right? Because by giving ACE inhibitors, you decrease angiotensin II, you sort of keep the efferent arterial open, right? And by doing that, you can sort of decrease that intraglomerular hypertension, so you sort of exert a protective effect on the kidneys, okay? And remember, your ACE inhibitors, you can actually also use them to treat the peripheral edema that's associated with your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? So like your amlodipine, felodipine, whatever. your dopamines, right? Those drugs, remember, those drugs can cause peripheral edema, right? And reflex tachycardia is a side effect. The reason they cause the reflex tachycardia is they vasodilate. So if you cause vasodilation, your heart is like, what's going on here, right? So your heart begins to beat a lot faster as a sort of like as a reflex, right? And again, if you want to dig real deep into pathophase, you can basically think about your vasodilate, your baroreceptor sense the low pressures, they're like, crap, let's try to respond to this. So you have like a massive sympathetic discharge, you activate your beta 1 receptors, and boom, your heart starts going a real fast, right? So your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, yes, you use those for, they can cause reflex tachycardia. The reason they cause peripheral edema, right? So again, if you think about your vessels, right? So remember your vessels, you have like your arteries, bam, they decrease, you form arterioles, and then from arterioles, you have capillaries where you have like absorption and all that crap taking place. And then after your capillaries, you have venules, right? So the thing is, your arterioles come before your capillaries. And the thing is, your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, they cause a dilation of your pre-capillary arterioles. So the arterioles that come before the capillaries, they dilate them, right? So if you dilate the pre-capillary arterioles, that will send more blood to your capillaries, right? So you're basically increasing the hydrostatic pressure in your capillaries. If you have that, you can have like fluid extravasation and you can get peripheral edema. However, if you're like, oh, okay, let's fix this peripheral edema, right? You can do that by trying to decrease that hydrostatic pressure in those capillaries, right? And the way you do that is by dilating, because remember I said arterioles lead to capillaries, capillaries lead to venules. So if you could, by some magic, dilate those venules that come after the capillaries, that would basically cause drainage of those capillaries, and that would decrease the hydrostatic pressures in those capillaries, right? So that's where your friendly ACE inhibitors come in. Your ACE inhibitors, they work specifically by dilating those post-capillary venules. So that's the pathophysiology behind them being used in the treatment of the peripheral edema that's associated with the use of your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? And then remember your nitroprusside, right? You can use it to treat like a hypertensive emergency. Works pretty well. Although, don't forget that you can leave a person on a nitroprusside drip for a long time, right? That can cause like bad cyanide toxicity, right? That's usually not a great outcome. Okay, and then remember hydralazine, right? Hydralazine, it's an awesome vasodilator. Remember, because it's a vasodilator, it can cause reflex tachycardia. And don't forget that hydralazine is also associated with the drug-induced lupus, right? With those antihistone antibodies, right? Let's see, what other cardiac drug can I talk about? Well, let's assume a person is in cardiogenic shock, right? You could consider giving them like dobutamine, right? Dobutamine. So remember, dobutamine, it's a beta 1 agonist, right? Remember, you can use it for those pharmacological stress tests. But remember from the ABI, like literally like the most recent podcast I made, where I said if a person has like a bad arrhythmia, bad tachycardia, those are contraindications to using dobutamine for those pharmacological stress tests. But basically, dobutamine is a beta 1 agonist, right? So it will increase your heart rate, it will increase your stroke volume, right? So ultimately, it will increase your cardiac output. You can use that for cardiogenic shock, right? Another drug you can use, cardiogenic shock, you can use milrinone, right? Remember, milrinone is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, right? So if you inhibit phosphodiesterase, that will increase your cyclic AMP, right? Remember, cyclic AMP is broken down by phosphodiesterase. So you inhibit phosphodiesterase, you will increase cyclic AMP. The thing is, if you remember from your preclinical coursework in med school, cyclic AMP does many different things, right? Depending on the kind of muscle you're dealing with. So if you're dealing with cardiac muscle, cyclic AMP actually causes like contraction of cardiac muscle. But if you actually have high levels of cyclic AMP in smooth muscle, that actually causes a relaxation of smooth muscle. So that's the pathophase behind milrinone being called an inodilator. You hear that classic mantra in critical care circles, inodilator. The reason it's called an inodilator is by inhibiting phosphodiesterase, it increases cyclic AMP in muscle. But in cardiac muscle, by increasing that cyclic AMP, it will cause increased contractility. In smooth muscle, by increasing that cyclic AMP, it will cause reduced contractility. So you have like smooth muscle dilation. And if you dilate smooth muscle, right, remember, smooth muscle is what lines your blood vessels. That will decrease your systemic vascular resistance, right? But if you increase cardiac contractility, that will increase your stroke volume, right? Your cardiac output goes up. Okay, so milrinone is an awesome drug because it increases your cardiac output, but it decreases afterload as well, right? By decreasing your systemic vascular resistance. Okay, so it's about 4 minutes to when I need to prepare to start going to work. So have a wonderful day. I hope you found this podcast to be helpful. This is, again, one of those podcasts that will generate you some points on pretty much any USMLE and pretty much any like medicine related board exam, right? So as I round up, right, I always say this, I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one, 2CK, 2CS, step three, and even like the COMLEX exams. I've actually tutored a bunch. I don't know why I've never really mentioned that, but I actually tutor a bunch of people on those COMLEX exams. And then like the preclinical exams in med school, the third year shelf exams, and then the medicine in training exam, right? And the medicine board exam, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for those. And then if you know a college student that needs tutoring like physics, general chemistry, organic chemistry, biochemistry, physiology, histology, I offer tutoring in all those things, right? Those subjects, thankfully, I still recall from college. Okay, and then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer like consulting and one-on-one guidance for that. I mean, pretty much everyone I worked with this last admission cycle, they all matched into their residencies. Most of them matched at their first choices, so take that for what you will. But I've actually been on the admissions committee of a top two med school for like a year, so I've sifted through thousands of applications, and I know the things that people watch out for in admissions committee. So if you need any help with that, feel free to reach out to me through the website, or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts, so podcast with an S at the end, at gmail.com. Okay, so have a wonderful day. I will see you in the next podcast, and God bless you. Thank you.